Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, several factors combined to make the last winter's flu season particularly bad in Wisconsin. We'll get a recap of how serious it was and how the state tracks the spread of the illness. First, it's our weekly look at some of the biggest stories in national politics. Someone leaked questions that special counsel Robert Mueller wants to ask President Trump during a sit-down interview. Some House Republicans have drafted impeachment papers for Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, and President Trump has delayed steel and aluminum tariffs on the European Union. You can call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on those issues. Have you looked at the questions that Mueller's team supposedly wants to ask the president? What do you think of them? What do they indicate about where the investigation is going? What questions do you want answered? And do you see reason for the deputy attorney general to be removed? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Callum Borchers is a reporter covering the intersection of politics and the media for The Fix at The Washington Post. Callum, good to have you back with us.
Glad to rejoin you.
So the New York Times published this list. It's questions, supposedly, that special counsel Robert Mueller and his people want to ask President Trump if they get a sit-down interview with him. 49 questions. Before we get to the content of them, there's questions about who leaked these questions. What do we know, if anything?
Well, it's hard to know for sure because this is a leak to the New York Times and not my newspaper, but every indication seems to be that it came from Trump's side and not from the special counsel's office, because the document described to the Times is one generated by Jay Sekulow, one of the president's personal attorneys, who was speaking by phone with attorneys in Robert Mueller's office and jotting down the questions that they wanted to ask the president. And it is that document that ended up in the Times' hands, although they say it came from someone outside of Trump's legal team. So there's virtually no chance that it came from the special counsel's office. It wouldn't make sense for Trump's lawyers to say to the special counsel, hey, here's our list of the questions you already have. What we have here is probably a situation where either Trump's lawyers were just careless with the list, or they facilitated a James Comey-style leak through an intermediary.
And why would the president's legal team want these questions out in the public eye?
Yeah, it's counterintuitive, right? And based on the president's furious reaction, you would sort of wonder that very thing. Why on earth would they want this to get out? But I think one obvious motive could be that they are trying to discourage him from sitting down with Mueller. And keep in mind that the president has repeatedly expressed his desire to do so, and that he feels confident that he could sort of talk his way out of any potential legal trouble. Now, more recently, we have reported that he's soured on the idea of sitting down with Mueller since the FBI raided the office, home, and hotel room of his another personal attorney, Michael Cohen. But still, if you're a member of his legal team and you've been trying to say to him, Mr. President, we really think it's a bad idea to talk to this guy, one way to get it through his head would be to put the questions out there, knowing that they would become a huge topic of discussion on cable news, and particularly Fox News. And then maybe if they haven't been able to get through to him, perhaps somebody like Sean Hannity or Laura Ingraham can, that those folks on TV will be saying, do not talk to Robert Mueller.
49 questions here. They cover a lot of ground. What struck you about the content, the issues covered in these questions?
Well, for one thing, contrary to the president's assertion on Twitter, there are multiple questions related to potential collusion with Russia during the 2016 presidential campaign. So that's number one. I think another thing that really stands out is that there are a lot of questions that seem aimed at determining whether the president obstructed justice. And you see a lot of questions phrased in such a way that they attempt to get at the president's state of mind. What was your intent? And I think that's one of the things that makes the questions potentially dangerous for the president. It's sort of a squishy thing. In other words, the president's legal team has argued that when he's executing his official duties as president, for example, he has the right to fire the director of the FBI. How could that possibly constitute obstruction of justice? But if the answer to the question, what was in your mind when you did that, is, well, I was trying to trip up the Russia investigation by getting Comey out of there, then perhaps it does veer into obstruction territory. And so I think that is one of the things to keep an eye on.
And there's particular questions about what the president intended by comments about former National Security Advisor, former General Flynn. Also questions about President Trump's comments on TV after the Comey firing, referencing Russia and the Russia investigation apparently as a reason for the Comey firing. That's the kind of stuff that the Mueller team might be really interested in.
Well, that's right. And of course, the president seems to have a real knack for phrasing things in a way that is somewhat vague and somewhat open to interpretation and kind of leave room for plausible deniability. And the Flynn example that you mentioned is a terrific point. For example, according to Comey, in his book and in his interviews and his testimony, the way the president phrased that request, as he views it, was, I hope you can see a way to letting this go. Now, Comey has said, I interpreted that as a directive from the President of the United States to drop the FBI's investigation of Michael Flynn. But a different interpretation of those remarks could be that the president was simply expressing his hope that that would be the eventual outcome. And so this is where the intent questions become just so tricky.
Talking to Callum Borchers from the Washington Post, rounding up some of the top news from national politics right now, our weekly news roundup. Before we move on from these questions, Callum, they're all sort of hypothetical because there is no sit-down scheduled between Mueller's team and President Trump. And there's reporting now that the special counsel had floated the idea to the president's legal team. Well, hey, one option, if you don't sit down voluntarily, we can try a subpoena and open some doors that haven't been opened before. What do we know about that?
Yes, as my colleague at The Fix, Aaron Blake, wrote today, it's really clear at this point that Robert Mueller's team is playing hardball here and basically saying one way or another, we are going to talk to the president. You know, sort of saying we can do this the easy way or the hard way. And we kind of saw that in probably the most recent example of a presidential subpoena, of course, was Bill Clinton, who was subpoenaed in the Paula Jones case, but then ultimately the subpoena was withdrawn because the president decided that he would make himself available voluntarily after all. And so that is a possible situation, too. In fact, in the special counsel, the current special counsel, we've seen something similar happen in the sense that a grand jury subpoena was issued to Stephen K. Bannon, the former chief strategist at the White House, and then also withdrawn because he volunteered to sit down on his own.
We'll have more on this story coming up tomorrow. We're planning to look at that at 4:30 tomorrow afternoon. Callum, a related issue, though, Rod Rosenstein, Deputy Attorney General there, maybe subject to impeachment. Some Republicans in the House Freedom Caucus, led by Mark Meadows of North Carolina, drafting a document. Why are they saying they're doing that?
Well, if you look at the articles themselves, they all, or most of them, sort of revolve around a central theme, which is the argument that Rod Rosenstein, as one of the folks who signed off on an application for a FISA warrant in 2016 of a Trump campaign aide, did so improperly. In other words, that he abused the FISA court. This is the very famous or infamous, depending on your view, dossier compiled by Christopher Steele, the former British spy, which was used apparently to some degree to generate the application for that FISA warrant. And as you and your listeners are surely aware, Republicans are absolutely furious about the use of that document to obtain a warrant and to surveil a member of the Trump campaign. And so what you have right now is sort of this split in the Republican caucus. There are members who are drafting these articles of impeachment, but House leadership and the Senate leadership, for that matter, on the Republican side, has consistently said that they think that the special counsel who is overseen by Rosenstein, that those folks ought to be left alone to do their jobs.
Now, speaking of leaks, a draft of those impeachment papers came out yesterday. Here's Rod Rosenstein. He was speaking at an event, I guess, at the museum. He was asked about that.
I just don't have anything to say about documents like that, that nobody has the courage to put their name on and that they leak in that way. But I can tell you, you know, there have been people who have been making threats privately and publicly against me for quite some time. And I think they should understand by now the Department of Justice is not going to be extorted.
So fairly strong words there. Can you talk about his reaction there?
Gee, I wonder who he could be talking about. Yeah, it's pretty... pretty obvious. I mean, this is a guy who appears, at least more recently, to be at peace. And according to our reporting and others, he was initially kind of rattled by the criticism he was getting, particularly from the president, who has called him, conflicted and someone who really should not be in the job. Although he has not moved to fire him, and more recently, though, people around Rosenstein have described him as content and at peace with whatever is going to happen, that he's basically decided I'm just going to do the job as long as I'm in it with as much integrity as I can and just not fret about what may come.
Was he quoting Martin Luther? Was that him? Here I stand, I can do no other? Is he getting ready to be fired,
right,
maybe?
Yeah, exactly.
Talking with Callum Borchers of the Washington Post about some of the top stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these leaked questions that the Mueller team would like to ask President Trump in a sit-down if they got one? Possible impeachment of Rod Rosenstein. How about a delay on tariffs against Canada, Mexico, and the European Union? And this Michelle Wolf performance at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. What do you think? Civility? Did this go too far? Is the backlash justified? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our talk with Callum Borchers, reporter for The Fix at The Washington Post, checking in on some of the biggest news from the Capitol. Callum, related to some of what we were talking about earlier, I want to talk about a story you wrote about the National Enquirer. Now, people who shop at grocery stores, including me, have been watching the headlines, very pro-Donald Trump on the front page of the National Enquirer. And this week, Michael Cohen, who had served as Donald Trump's lawyer for years, under federal investigation now, cover read Trump's fixers' secrets and lies. So what does this mean something?
Well, Michael Cohen sure seems to think so. I think what's really striking about this episode was that when CNN asked him earlier this week, do you think that this National Enquirer issue is an attempt to send you a message? And his response was, what do you think? Right, sort of saying, obviously, yes, it is. And the message, of course, is you better stay loyal to the president. Do not flip. And this is, of course, all stemming from the FBI raid that we talked about earlier. He is under federal investigation for possible bank fraud, wire fraud, and campaign finance violations. And one of the concerns presented to the president by his attorneys and some informal advisors is that Michael Cohen knows a lot about you, and he might try to cut a deal to avoid legal jeopardy for himself. He might be willing to turn over damaging information about you, Mr. President. And although Trump has said on Twitter that he doesn't think that is going to happen, it's been pretty hard for the White House to mask his concern. And so this appears, at least in Cohen's mind, to be one effort to keep him quiet.
And can you talk about the connections between President Trump over the years and the leadership at this at the tabloid, the National Enquirer?
Well, David Pecker, who is the publisher of The Enquirer, he's the chief executive of American Media, which is the parent company of The Enquirer. He and the president are personal friends. And if you read closely The Enquirer's most recent statement denying Trump's influence over their publication, it's really what I would call a non-denial denial, in the sense that it's so specific that it leaves a lot of other ways that the president could be influential. So he says, well, the president does not weigh in on editorial decisions. He hasn't asked us to kill stories. He hasn't told us to write specific stories. But, of course, what he told The New Yorker magazine last year was that he paid $150,000 to Karen McDougal, the former Playboy model who claims to have had an affair with Trump in 2006 and 2007, to keep her mouth shut during the campaign about that alleged affair. And his reasoning was, I'm a personal friend, and you cannot be bashing Trump and American media. And The New Yorker's Jeffrey Toobin said to him, well, it's not the same thing. Trump and American media are not the same thing. And Pecker's response was, in my mind, they are. He's a personal friend. And so I think what you see there is this really explicit admission by The Enquirer that they do try to protect Trump, even if they're not getting direct orders from the Oval Office.
I want to bring in a caller now on the latest out of Washington. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. The question I have for your guest is, it seems to me that all the problems with the Justice Department from Comey on down is the fact that everyone thought Hillary was going to win. Everybody knew that she broke the law with her private server, yet they didn't want to prevent her from being president because she inadvertently messed up over her private emails. And conversely, they didn't want Trump and didn't think he was going to win and knew that if she did win, that their jobs would be on the line if they really pressed the issue. Isn't the fact that everyone thought Hillary was going to win the presidency the cause for all that's going on at the Justice Department?
Charlie, thanks for the call. Callum, thoughts?
Well, I think there's a lot of merit to the theory. I mean, you've heard James Comey on his book tour talk about the fact that his actions must have been influenced to some degree by the fact that, as he put it, we were all living in a world in which Hillary Clinton was going to be president. And part of the calculus, seemingly, would be, you know, when he discovered shortly before Election Day that there were emails on this new laptop device. Keep in mind, this was sort of an unrelated investigation. It was Anthony Weiner's sexting investigation that produced a laptop also used by his wife, Huma Abedin, who worked for the Clinton campaign, on which there were additional emails discovered. And Comey says, I had a decision to make. Do I alert Congress to the fact that we are going to be examining new emails, or do I conceal it? And he felt that since Clinton was likely to win, he could envision a scenario in which Clinton wins the presidency. He doesn't disclose the additional emails to Congress until after Election Day. And then Republicans in Congress throw a fit, and they say that he essentially covered for Clinton at the end of the campaign, and that there are years of hearings about that. And that's what he was trying to avoid.
And then what ended up happening is he did acknowledge that they were investigating these emails, and now Clinton supporters and Hillary Clinton herself have pointed to that announcement, saying that might have been enough to tip the balance to Donald Trump.
That's exactly right, and this is why he feels that he was in a no-win situation, and he feels as though there was really no option to do nothing. You know, he would say, and has said in his interviews, that there is sort of this false choice out there, that he had an option to just do nothing. As he says, look, if either way, it's an affirmative action. I can actively conceal these new emails that we are looking into, or I can actively tell Congress about them. But there isn't an option, as he put, there's no door that says do nothing.
Thanks for that call, Charlie. Talking to Callum Borchers from The Washington Post, looking at some of the big stories in national news. Let's quick touch on these tariffs, or at this point, non-tariffs right now, steel and aluminum. President Trump, the White House said, hey, another 30-day extension, another hold. We're not going to impose these tariffs on steel and aluminum for Canada, Mexico, and the European Union, but we're not going to do them eventually. What do we know about that?
Yeah, there seems to be some wiggle room for there to be a permanent exemption there. We didn't get a lot of detail when Sarah Sanders was asked about this at the briefing yesterday. There was no briefing today, but she basically said, I'm not going to have any announcement, but that negotiations with those countries are ongoing. I think it's also interesting, though, to point out that, as Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, said the other day, that if the United States is going to impose these tariffs, it really needs to do so quickly, because otherwise they will lose their effectiveness. In other words, he seems to be concerned that another country that has a permanent exemption, say South Korea, could become kind of a way station for steel from other countries that are subject to the tariff, right? So, I mean, if you're China, for example, and you know, well, if I ship the steel directly to the U.S., I'm going to get whacked with this big tariff. Maybe I can just send it to South Korea first and then have the shipment come from South Korea, and that's a way to work around it. And I think that's what Ross is talking about, trying to avoid people gaming the system, as he put it.
And Callum, I want to take our last few minutes and look at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. This thing happens every year. Usually the president's there. President Trump has opted out of going to these things. And comedian Michelle Wolf was brought in, as comedians are, to roast the president and the administration and the media sometimes. People, a lot of backlash on this one. People unhappy with what she had to say. What is getting people's attention on this one?
Well, probably the biggest criticism has centered on the way that she went after Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House press secretary. And there is some disagreement about what her intent was. A lot of the criticism centers on the impression that she was making fun of Sanders' physical appearance at times. She has said no, that was not her intent. But she did say that she liked Sarah Huckabee Sanders as Aunt Lydia in The Handmaid's Tale. That was one of her jokes. And one way to look at that is, well, she was just talking about being a sort of mean-spirited person and someone who is unhelpful to the cause of feminism. Another way to look at it is to also say, yeah, but the whole package is she was comparing her to an unflattering figure on TV. And she also did make a reference to Sarah Huckabee Sanders' perfect smoky eye, as she put it. She did say that it was perfect. But again, I think people are wondering, why are you talking about the press secretary's physical appearance at all?
How did this one compare to roasts at past events, at the past annual events?
Well, that's a good question. And I looked back at that this week. And, you know, humor is subjective, I suppose, but it seems to me that there has been a lot of pointed, personal, and cutting jokes over the years at this dinner. And what's different, unquestionably, is the atmosphere in Washington around this particular president, who, as you said, has not gone to the last two correspondence dinners, even though other presidents have. And I think what's different about it is that while other presidents didn't really like going and didn't always find the jokes funny, they sort of decided to just grin and bear it and put up with it. And this president does not. He does not bear it. And in fact, he has decided to weaponize the jokes at the White House correspondence dinner and use it to discredit the media or look like make the media out to be his enemy and to be biased. And I think that is something that is different. I mean, all presidents complain about their coverage to some degree, but it seems to me that the White House Correspondents Association can't get away with what it used to get away with, because we have a president right now who will take every example he possibly can, even if it's from a non-journalist, even if it's from a comedian, will gladly take that material and say, see, this proves that the media is just out to get me and they hate me and they can't possibly be fair.
It's always been a weird event in a way, because in theory, the White House correspondents are holding the White House accountable. It's kind of an adversarial relationship. They don't want to appear too cozy laughing along together. Also, the subject of the roast is the sitting president having to put up with whatever the comedian is saying. Is there talk of just ending this event or changing the format or something?
There's some of both, yeah. I think that the latter is probably more likely. You have had folks call for a total end to the event altogether. There's no indication from the association that that is a possible route, but you did see Margaret Tolliff, who is the current president, say that she and Olivier Knox, who is the incoming president, they are going to hear from members about what they think the format should look like going down the line. So that could mean losing the roast element. Keep in mind that most of the dinner is devoted to handing out awards and scholarships. It's just that that's the stuff that's, you know, sort of insidery and boring, and we don't watch that part on TV. So it could just be a totally different event. And frankly, it has changed a little bit in recent years anyway. We've seen less of a Hollywood presence.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Callum Borchers from The Washington Post and our weekly look at national politics. Coming up, the numbers on a tough flu season in Wisconsin. This is Central Time.